Most of us, I would imagine, like getting an invitation to go to a party. Parties are an opportunity to get dressed up, to catch up with old friends, and perhaps to meet some new people. An invitation usually contains a lot of important information that helps us to negotiate some of the etiquette of a party. It will tell us who the party's for, the reason why the party's being held. It'll tell us the place of the event and the day and the time, and sometimes it might tell us what the expectation of clothing is. But the rules of the parties we're going to aren't always there on the invitation. For those people who are a little more shy of life, an invitation can lead to more worrying questions than the delight and the thrill of something ahead. There are the key questions of what will I wear? Will there be food? Do I need to bring a gift? Will there be people I know? And what will be expected of me while I am there? There are those in the world who would prefer a full letter of explanation as an invite rather than the A5 card with just the important details. Those who want to make sure they don't offend anyone and they don't look out of place. I've been glad to discover I'm not the only one who worries about the rules for parties. As recently I spent a coffee time running through events for a week in May with a friend who's not sure if her wardrobe's going to accommodate the kind of clothes that she might need. When it comes to weddings, though, most people are fairly sure of the etiquette for the day. Perhaps the most important thing to know is that it is the bride who wears white. It's her and the groom's big day, and if she wants to shine in a white, an ivory, or a cream gown, then let her. When it comes to the meal, remember to keep your hat on until the mother of the bride takes hers off. She's probably spent a fortune on it. She wants to make sure she's used it to its full potential, so it doesn't matter if you're still wearing it as the coffee, tea, and tablet are shared across the table. If wearing it for that long is going to bother you, forget the hat from the beginning. And lastly, every wedding will be remembered because at least one thing went wrong, and at the end of the day, it didn't matter. Instead, all that mattered was that two special people spoke publicly of how much love and the uniqueness of their love mattered. The potential or real disasters are significant moments at weddings because they forge the actions of others together. I can say that with genuine conviction because Keith and my wedding offered a variety of moments when it looked like it all might go wrong, only for the memory to make us smile. You need an hour for us to tell you. We don't have that. Ministry has taught me to encourage couples to not worry about the things they can't control and to forewarn them of some of the things they can. So sanding the bottom of your shoes is a good idea. Usually with the smooth bottoms of wedding shoes, the transition from the damp ground outside to carpet can lead the sole to slip across the carpet. A wee hook at the top of the zip will ensure that the sleeveless dress does not accidentally come undone as your promises are being made. Checking the base of your shoes to ensure that the words "help me" have not been written by an exuberant groomsman ready for all to see when you kneel. Bring your marriage schedule to the rehearsal so that there's not an opportunity to forget to bring it with you on the day. Please don't be late without good reason, as it makes the groom more nervous, and potentially the minister, church officer, and the organist may have to go because they are expected elsewhere later in the afternoon. If there is a good reason, phone ahead. Calm those who are waiting. Eat before you come, and wriggle every so often, because otherwise you'll faint. Don't pass the fountain pen between each other. Put it on the table carefully and allow each person to pick it up as they need to. Even a signed marriage schedule posted in a red pillar box rather than the registry office letterbox will eventually make its way to the correct destination. These may sound like the result of daft moments, But every one was the potential disaster that brought those who were there closer together with an unforgettable moment. Our reading from the Gospel is one that people tell me that they hear at every wedding. And that's not true. Instead, it's there as a reminder of the story in the opening statement about what marriage is. The most popular biblical reading at weddings is 1 Corinthians 13. The marriage at Cana of Galilee is the story of a potential disaster. The wine running out might not seem like a disaster to us, but we don't live in an honour culture. Not having enough wine for all the guests would have suggested that the family were unable to meet the obligations of hospitality. And that would lead to a permanent shaming of the couple and their families, and potentially would have lowered their status within the community. 3 weeks on from Christmas and in the season of Epiphany, we are given a story about a wedding so that we might learn a little bit more about who Jesus is. Like the humble beginnings of the Son of God, there's a humility within the story and the setting to be noticed. The Christ child birthed into a building where animals took shelter in a rundown town once famous for being the birthplace of a king, entered the world encountering the outcast, refugee, and stranger. Luke's Gospel demonstrates that with shepherds, Matthew with stable and foreigners. John's Gospel also offers humble beginnings, not in a birth, but at a wedding. We've no idea who the couple are. There's no real knowledge of where Cana was, instead at least four potential locations. So in an unknown backwater, where people who were probably not particularly wealthy met, Jesus demonstrates that God is for everyone. The wealth of God, the promise of God, the overflowing love of God was to be shared with those who were ignored and undervalued. The story also offers an opportunity to comment on relationships. And within the story, we meet the relationship of Jesus and his mother, of Jesus and the couple, and of God with the community. It's the kind of story where we try to lay all kinds of emotions on the conversation between Mary and her son. Like a text message or an email, there's no way to read the intonation or emotion behind the facts we're offered. Is Mary being a proud mother pushing her son forward? Is she pleading with him, telling him just to get on with it? And in Jesus' response, is he frustrated? Is he laughing? Perhaps he's teasing. Whatever the emotion, perhaps we sense Mary's concern for the couple and her firm belief in the abilities of her son. Perhaps we should discover Jesus as the son who still obeys his parents, the son who still listens to parental advice, although prepared to challenge it to find his own way in life. In Jesus' relationship with the couple, we should sense a man prepared to help anyone, a divine presence that believes everyone matters. That's why we're told no details of who the couple are, because it doesn't matter. The presence of God, the love of God, the grace of God, they're given to all, no matter status, wealth, talent, gender, or creed, and given abundantly. This morning, because of the Gospel reading, as I said at the beginning of the service, I decided it would be a good opportunity to invite some of those who'd been married in the last 3 years back and to join us for worship here at 11 o'clock. I'm delighted that actually so many of them have joined us. The percentage when you invite people to a church event is usually 5%. And so 5% of 39 is sort of part of a person. Well, we've got more than part of a person. I think we're nearly at a quarter of those who've been married. And I think that's a really lovely thing to have happened this morning, and I do appreciate it. But I invited them for two reasons, quite purposefully, and a third accidentally that appeared as the week drew to a close. When a wedding is mentioned, what an opportunity to celebrate the promises that these couples have made in this building. As a Christian community, we invite people to celebrate their marriages within this space, in this place that we consider holy and special, because we believe that the symbolism of their love reminds us of the power of the love of God and inspires us to bring love to all of our relationships. And if we've listened to all the readings and expectations of love found within the Bible, then we know that it's not wishy-washy, romantic love. Instead, it's a love that puts others first and encourages us to seek the best in others, even at times when that comes at a cost to ourselves. Then I've invited the married couples to remind us that the heavenly wedding feast is never-ending. God welcomes us back to gather and celebrate each time we're here, to drink his grace abundantly. Each time we meet should be like the wedding feast. It doesn't matter who's here or where it takes place. What matters is that the divine presence gathers us together to restore us for what lies ahead. In a piece written by Anna Shirey, she says, "If Jesus is a reflection of the Creator, and Jesus came laughing and dancing and being the life of the party, then perhaps we begin to set aside our image of a stern God who provides to test us, or a heartbroken God who mourns our shortcomings. Perhaps we begin to imagine a God who delights in us, who walks with us not because it's God's burden to do so, but because it's joyful and energizing. God enjoys us when we're laughing, when we're crying, when we're trying, when we're failing. It is simply in God to love us, and so God does." How might we remind ourselves of God's unbridled love beyond the celebration of the vows that couples have made? Perhaps it's remaining within that celebration by spending time together with others. Perhaps if you haven't been for coffee between the two services for a while, or you've never been at all, then next week is the moment to do so. But this week, stay and linger. Enjoy the party. Enjoy the celebration. Let it set you up for the week that lies ahead. Take the fellowship of this building and let it linger for a little into the morning and then into the week. As I said, a third purpose in inviting the couples appeared as the week drew to a close. We delight in their love, and rightly so, for it offers signs of the kingdom of heaven. But in this week, we have been reminded that we're not always so willing to welcome alternative visions of heaven. That discrimination because of gender and sexuality is given greater power and presence than the revelation of love in the midst of human life. I know that some won't agree with me. And I know that sexuality continues to be a theological hot potato. Yet it is a continuing concern that the bedroom practices of some and not of others should be of more interest than ensuring the priority of justice and the recognition of the value of all people. So to close with words from Anna Shirey again. If God has it in God to love without limit, to celebrate all things, to experience unbridled joy in this world, perhaps it's safe to suggest that the same is true of us. Maybe it's time for us to take ourselves a little less seriously and open to joy, to laugh, to dance, to celebrate not only the many blessings given us, but even celebrate ourselves. Perhaps when we can celebrate the whole of our being, we will recognize and value every part of the life of others and then invite them. and make them welcome at the feast. Amen.